succession number 8256, reel number 3.
Mr. Osborne, reel 3.
I fitted the quarter seam to the decking, and as it was a place where we spent so much time, it was nice to sit on instead of the steel deck. But after the first torpedo or torpedoes hit the Prince of Wales, we ran into lots of trouble, and we had in our turret hydraulic fluid which ran all across the quarter seam, and with the list we couldn't keep our feet, the two of us, in this small working space. I had my oilskin hanging up, so I just threw it on the floor, which enabled us to keep our feet. The engagement went on. We were firing at aircraft, and one is encased in this metal, so one isn't aware of the detail of what is going on. But there was a lull in the engagement with the aircraft, and we came out of the turret and stood on the catapult deck. And the captain came from the bridge during this time, and he stopped to speak to us, and he said that he was going to get a destroyer alongside to take off the wounded and non-essential personnel, and he would hope to get the Prince of Wales towed back to Singapore. He was keeping the anti-aircraft crews. And he looked at me and he said, "I'm sorry, you can't go," because I was standing there in my boiler suit, anti-flash gloves and anti-flash balaclava type helmet. And he was still the elegant naval officer. His ship was lost. He went back up the ladder to the S2 gun platform and presumably back up to the bridge. Shortly after that, we had some high-level bombers back in the turret, and one bomb, I think it must have been dead center. In fact, I would think that it went between the rails of the catapult and exploded on the armored deck below. And they had brought a lot of wounded people up to the canteen flat below prior to getting them aboard the destroyer when it came alongside.
To which flat?
Canteen flat. And was it canteen flat or cinema flat? You know, after 40 odd years, one. We had two. We had a canteen flat and a cinema flat. I think it was the canteen flat. Or was it? I don't know. It was the deck below the catapult deck, and there was the armoured hatch, which was about so thick, which went through to the...
About 8 inches thick.
About so thick, yes. It was on... The armoured hatch at that point was on one of these chain lifts. We had the bomb hit quite close to the turret. The door hadn't been closed properly, and the turret was filled with acrid fumes. I thought at first it was gas, but it wasn't, just the fumes from the explosion. Then things went quiet again, and ours was about, I think ours was about the only turret that was firing, or capable of firing at this time, and the second gunnery officer was closely associated with the boys on board the Prince of Wales, about 180 of us, I think. And he came down to our turret, and really there was no direct control, just local firing, and these planes were very high. He sat at the back of the turret looking at these planes. There wasn't any need for all of us to be in there because we could only fire the odd shell. And he was saying, right a bit, left a bit, and up a bit. I think they're about X feet. I think he said 10,000 feet. And all this time he was peeling an orange. And he said, "All right, fire, would you like a quarter?" He said to, I think it was Shears, he said, offered it to, I'm not really sure. One of the boys in the turret, he was just outside the door of the turret, offered a segment of the orange, although he said a quarter. And the express came alongside, and the express was one of the escorting destroyers. She made it all the way through the war, actually. And my last instructions, and they were from the captain himself, was, I'm afraid you can't go. So I stood on the gun deck of S2 turret, watching the wounded being taken aft and across the express, and all the men going aboard, climbing over ropes, leaping, jumping as ships came together. And as I stood there, leaning on the guardrail, I saw all the Carly floats being thrown over the side, the nets, and being tethered alongside with the heaving line, and the boom which lay anchored to the deck alongside a turret that went over the side. In fact, almost anything that could float was being thrown over the side, but unfortunately there were people already in the water below, and they were, some of them were being hit by stuff going over the side. One or two went between the destroyer and the Prince of Wales. Well, finally, it was obvious that we weren't going to be needed any more aboard, and the petty officer, Leather, who was the captain of our turret, said, that's it, or something like that. And I came down to the waist of the ship on the catapult deck, and water was already up the side, and there were an awful lot of men still trying to get onto the express, and I decided that what I'd better do is go over the side of the ship rather than get tangled up. And I don't remember any panic at all. I was rather surprised at the people that were in my turret. We were wearing boiler suits. We took off our anti-flash gear, and I did a silly thing. I took my shoes and socks off, and I folded my socks off and put them up inside my shoes, and folded my boiler suit up and put it on top of my shoes, and I looked and I could see the water coming up the deck, over the deck, and I looked to my right, and people were doing the same thing from the turret, just folding their clothes up. Well, we had what are inflatable life belts. They're just a straight piece of tube which you put a tape around your neck and tie the tube around your waist, and you blow into it to blow them up. Have a long nozzle. And I'd got about two puffs in mine. I think I put one in when the first torpedo hit us. But being a very careful person, I knew where there was a locker of these cork life belts quite close to S2 turret, again in the waist of the ship. And I opened this locker, and sure enough, full of cork life belts, and I took one of these, and very soon they'd all disappeared. And a man came up to me. He was in the supply branch. He couldn't swim, or he told me he couldn't swim, and he hadn't got a life belt. And he wanted me to give him one of my life belts. Well, obviously I'd got to, but it was a very, very big decision to make, which one to give him. Eventually I kept the service issue and gave him the cork life belt. And you know, I helped pull that man in aboard the express. It's quite a coincidence. Surprising what a small world it is. I met my brother in Colombo. Our paths crossed. I gave a man a life belt on the Prince of Wales, and I helped pull him in on board the express. Well, we stooged around on the express, picking up survivors, and late afternoon we headed for Singapore. Prince of Wales went down. Sad, really, you know. It's don't think people who've not experienced a ship they've lived on sinking can appreciate how it tugs at you to see it going.
What was it like in the water?
I was not in the water. I ran aft, round all the men who were on the waist trying to get across the ropes, and as she was moving away, the two ships were held together and the Prince of Wales was rolling, and I jumped for the express and caught the guardrails and heaved myself over. Then of course the express started going at that time with the Prince of Wales, but they managed to cut the ropes or hawsers that were, get rid of the hawsers that were holding her in, and she went astern. And the amazing thing was that the express came alongside beautifully. She came alongside a sinking ship beautifully, and yet she had a dent in her bows from going alongside a jetty. That's one of the things I remember when I stood on the turret looking at her. She came alongside so beautifully, and yet she got this dent in her bows from the jetty. A jetty up somewhere or other.
What's happened to you in Singapore?
Oh, well, we got down to Singapore. They tried to push rum into you, and I didn't like rum, and the doctor ran his hands over you. At the end of the table, you offered more rum. You gave your name, rank and number, and got into a lorry. I think there must have been transposition of figures in my number, because presumably they just sent the numbers home to start with, because my mother was told that I was missing, believed, killed. But we put into these lorries and taken to the Fleet Shore accommodation, and of course I had got any shoes on, and I jumped out of the lorry and onto gravel, which was my first meeting with the Fleet Shore accommodation. Then we went into the accommodation. The beds had been, mattresses had been taken off the beds, put on the floor, so you had either a bed without a mattress or a mattress on the floor, and I seem to have slept through that night until about midday the following day. And we were eventually issued with khaki shorts, khaki shirts and a naval cap, which eventually had to be camouflaged with khaki. But it really was sad, Prince of Wales.
Did people seem to be satisfied with the reception and treatment they got at Singapore?
Initially, yes. But I think there was a little unhappiness, because the people that had been, how true this was, I don't know, but it, the feeling was certainly there that people that had been in the, at home and had 2 years or more of war, got out to the Far East, and people that had been in the Far East were clamouring to get back home as soon as the war started, so that service naval personnel who had been out there for the first 2 years of the war wanted to get back home, and the, we who had been at home were staying there. In fact, I stayed in Singapore until a few days before it fell, although Churchill said no one under the age of 18 shall serve on land abroad. He had perhaps 150 boy seamen there. Just before Singapore fell, there were perhaps about 30 of us left in Singapore. And I think it probably came to someone that clearly there were still some boy seamen in Singapore. We'd been working up the coast of Malaya, running around Singapore, trying to make believe there was a naval presence. And I think it was clear that someone suddenly realised we were there, because there were some ships in Keppel Harbour, the what I call the lie boats, the woe boats, sorry. Lai Wo, Ping Wo, Kong Wo, Siang Wo. And from the boys who were on the Siang Wo, that is the ship I was on, it was obvious that someone had taken the list and said, from A to E, presumably, will go to the Kong Wo, and from L to P will go to the Siang Wo, which included me, because the names were of the boys who went on to the Siang Wo were Lawrence, McGarry, Neville, Osborne and Pritchard. About five of us went on to each one.
What duties were you supposed to be having on these boats?
Well, we weren't assigned duties as such on the boats. The first, I joined the Siang Wo during an air raid, and she just disappeared in the bomb splashes. I thought, well, that's my ship gone. But as the splashes subsided, she was still there, belching smoke from her funnel. She was a coal-burning ship, by the way, built about 1924. I went aboard the Siang Wo, and the first job I had on board the Siang Wo was to mix concrete to fill the holes. And we lasted about 3 days after that, running south from Singapore with all the other little ships.
What had the Siang Wo's function supposed to have been?
She was a converted merchant ship. She was an auxiliary. She had a 4-inch gun, a couple of Lewis guns, the Vickers, depth charges, and a peculiar thing that projected hand grenades. But I don't think any of us got through from that lot. I ended up on Bangkor, an island called Bangkor, in south of Singapore. Rather a nasty island.
Why was it so nasty?
Well, it was a place that survivors of ships got to. Was I lucky? I don't know. I was lucky in the one respect that I got there before the Japanese invaded the island. People coming out of the water from the ships that were being sunk all around the island on the way from Singapore didn't get far from the water up the beach because they were met by the Japanese. There are a host of books listing the Viner Brook, all sorts of ships that were sunk. People were slaughtered. Bangkor is an island, and I think I'd rather not dwell on at this time on the what happened on Bangkor.
I think going back earlier, you were on the Mediterranean convoys as well on the Prince of Wales.
We took a convoy pathway across to Newfoundland and came back in a wide sweep to Gibraltar, and I can clearly see the Rodney on the horizon as we approached, challenging, and our reply as we challenged each other, and we met up with the convoy heading towards the Mediterranean. We sailed on, and then one day we put on speed and we did a very quick trip through the straits, and I stood on the deck. It was dark and there were a line of boats with lights on. Presumably they were marking the channel because we went through at high speed. We oiled and came back out again into the Atlantic, joined up with the convoy again. And the following night, we went through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Mediterranean. I assume that we went through the first night to oil at speed so that watchers ashore wouldn't see that the KG-5 class battleship was entering the Mediterranean or in that area. We had quite a good run through. Usual submarine alarms you could hear when you were below, you could hear the thump of depth charges, but they were miles and miles away. Sound travels so much underwater. There was one day when it got particularly hot. We had the Ark Roar with us, the Rodney, the Nelson, cruisers, destroyers, and perhaps 10 or 12 fairly fast merchant ships. And this day when it got to be quite fierce, we were engaging aircraft all the time. The Ark Royal fighters seemed to be able to split the formations up. They came in singly. And the umbrella of the fleet seemed to be able to cope with the aeroplanes that came in or got through the fighter screens. We did shoot one former down and one or two Italian aircraft, but the former came out, presumably he was on the tail. He was on the tail of an Italian aircraft, but presumably he was excited, didn't want to let go, and penetrated the umbrella screen. We knocked him down, and fortunately a destroyer picked the pilot up. We had a misfire during that engagement, and of course the routine is go through the circuits, change the circuits, and see if you can clear the round without opening the breech. Well, in training one is taught that one waits half an hour before, or something like that, before opening a breech after you've gone through all these routines. But when you're being attacked by aircraft, you don't wait for half an hour. Captain of the turret gave the order to open the breech. The breech was opened, and the 525s were too big, heavy and cumbersome to have the brass cylinder permanently attached to the shell. So when the projectile and the cordite were put into the gun, they were put into a tray, and as the tray moved over in line with the breech, a little lever went down and the two moved together so that when they were rammed home they became one, what one would call, quick-firing piece of ammunition. So that when the breech was opened, this hot cylinder came flying out. The breech was opened very, very quickly, and it went down the well to where all these expended cylinders went. And Petty Officer Leather told me to go down and find the live one and throw it over the side. And I looked at him and said, "What, me?" And he said, "You're the cordite number, aren't you? Go down below and find it." So I went out and into the working space, and the turret revolves around this ring, as I explained earlier, and I was young. I was 17 by this time. And the captain of the turret knew I was going through the ring. The power was still on, and I threw myself through to the centre into this space where all these cylinders were. And there was a mountain of hot cylinders, and I was looking for one that hadn't been discharged. And I thought it would roll to the bottom, but no, it was lodged at the top. And the only reason I saw it was they had a silver disc in the top. So the disc was painted silver, a metal disc in the top, which was painted silver. Saw this metal disc in this one cylinder, hot cylinder, picked it up, scrambled through again. We had a port in the side of the working space which you could wind down so that when you got too many cylinders inside the working space, you could throw them onto the deck. There was a wire screen to stop them from going over the side. And the cylinder just went out and over the side. We also had one shell with the nose fuse hanging off, and someone said to me, "Here, take this." And I looked at this thing with the nose fuse hanging off and passed it to the next one in the turret and said, "Here, take this." And it's quite remarkable how safe I felt after having passed it to someone, although an 85-pound shell was no more than a foot, 2 feet away from me. I felt safe because it wasn't in my hands. The Rodney received a torpedo right up forward, and you know, the Rodney and Nelson, they were funny looking ships. They had this magnificent bow and this very short stern. They'd been cut off and the turrets weren't put on the stern. When she took in water up forward, her stern lifted out of the water.
Did you see this?
Yes. The Nelson was then going along with this huge bow, slightly down in the water, way up forward, and it brought this short, blunt stern out of the water. And it did look really funny. Someone ought to have said, you know, send a signal, your knickers are showing, or something like that.
This is the Rodney.
I know, that was Nelson. Did I say Rodney?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, the Rodney we picked up shortly after that, and we had heard that the Italian fleet was coming out, so we made tracks away from the convoy with Rodney in tow. And the difference in speeds was enormous, and I don't know what time, surely late afternoon, the Rodney was almost hull down on the horizon astern. Then we turned back, made for the convoy. One merchant ship had been hit while we were away, but we ran as far as we were supposed to, going into Malta, and turned back for Gibraltar.
Going back to something you said earlier, you were going to say something about cameras aboard ship.
Oh yes, the cameras aboard ships, there were probably quite a lot, but amongst boy seamen, cameras were, I only know of one actually. And he was on the multiple pom-poms, and during the engagement with the Bismarck, they had a cabin or a shack that they used to shelter in, and he was taking photographs of the hood. I didn't know this at the time, and when we got to Rosyth, the starboard watch, of which I and he were part, were going on leave before anyone else, before the port watch, and he came up to me. We were quite worried. He had a film. He said he got photographs of the hood engaging the Bismarck and blowing up. And he got the roll of film and he didn't know what to do with it. He wanted to take it home, but he couldn't think of a way of getting it through past the dockyard police. Well, quite wrongly, I took the film off him, got a bar of soap, the issue soap, which is about 8 or 9 inches long, square, cut it in half, hollowed it out, wrapped the film up, put the film in, sealed it again. He took the film home in that. And I don't know what happened to that film to this day, whether he did get it developed or what happened to it. Wrongly, with hindsight, obviously I'm terribly wrong in not telling someone on board the Prince of Wales about this film, because it would have been most important in deciding what happened to the hood. It could have been, if the camera photographs had been taken at precise moments when things happened. But I don't know what was on the film, but he did say that he had taken photographs of the hood. I've no reason to doubt him, because he was certainly quite worried about it. And he wouldn't have gone to the trouble of trying to find a way to take it safely past the dockyard police.
Also, you said that you made a remark about the Bismarck action, about a suggestion which you made.
Oh, yes. When we were running in to engage the Bismarck, I turned to the captain of the turret and asked why he didn't send us round to the back of the Bismarck, he being Admiral Holland. And I got the standard answer, gunnery answer, of having one gun platform. But I believe that had Admiral Holland sent the Prince of Wales round,